You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate. The Belgian painter René Magritte created some of the most unsettling, funny, bizarre, and enduring images in the 20th century. A new exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art looks at the early years of his career and how he came to develop iconic works. Magritte, The Mystery of the Ordinary, 1926-1938, is on view until January 12th. Better hurry, and it's accompanied by a handsome catalog. I'm delighted to welcome the show's curator, Anne Unlem, to the Leonard Lopate Show. Great to meet you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I should say at the outset, we're going to talk about a lot of paintings. So if people go to WNYC.org and go to the Leonard Lopate Show page, there are links to many of the images that we're going to be talking about, and people can follow along. And a slideshow as well about all the images that we'll be talking about. So many of Magritte's paintings have become so familiar, almost in a way cliche or iconic. The False Mirror, I think people know it, depicts an eye with an iris replaced by the sky. What do we learn in this new show that we didn't know before?
I think you learn, in the first place, how radically inventive and imaginative Magritte was in the 13-year period that we look at in this show, and how the sorts of images he developed went way beyond those sky-filled eyes. You see the range of strategies he devised to defamiliarize the familiar. You know, everything from, I suppose, the most famous image is probably the one called The Treachery of Images, or Ceci n'est pas une pipe, this is not a pipe,
right?
That has that great picture of a very clear, bold, legible image of a pipe.
Looks like a pipe to me.
Looks, but as Magritte would say, right, no one could smoke his pipe, so therefore it is not one. So this way of making you look at something, say, oh, I know that what that is, and then the next moment be confounded or made to think again, maybe it's not.
One of the things I learned, too, is the titles are no help in trying to figure out what the painting is. They don't seem to match in any way.
Right, they don't. It's one of the hardest exhibitions to work on in that way. And Magritte specifically thought of his titles. He described them as a protective device, something to prevent overly facile or simple readings of the images in his works.
I mean, you're going to hear us a lot in the next few minutes go, say the title, and it's the one with.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you have to describe it. Are there works in this exhibition at MoMA now that have not been seen in this country before?
Yes, there are a number of works that have not been seen in this country before. Probably the most popular one is an image called Not to Be Reproduced, which, as it turns out, is, of course, the most reproduced of Magritte's
pictures.
He
was asking for that.
Yeah, he was asking for that one. It's a double portrait, or what Magritte called a portrait manqué, a failed portrait of his great patron, Edward James. And you see a man from the back with beautifully coiffed hair staring into a mirror, and the mirror gives you back not his face, as you have every right to expect, but the back of his head yet again. And so Magritte often uses things like doubling or concealing or ways of telling you that he's withholding information. That's another way that he helps make sort of everyday, ordinary objects or people look strange.
Well, as you mentioned, the exhibition's title is The Mystery of the Ordinary. Expand on that a little bit. What's that mean?
Yes. Well, it's hopefully conveys in a very simple way what the essence is of Magritte's art, and which is this uncanny ability, I think, to make everyday objects look different, look mysterious, look strange, or conversely, as he himself said, to make the strange begin to look familiar. And so that flipping back and forth between what is mysterious and what is ordinary, how one modifies the other, they also both are words that he used a lot. So we put them together to make the title.
You concentrate on 1926 to 1938. Why this particular period? Why is it so significant?
Yeah. Well, there are a number of different reasons. I suppose the first thing I'd say is that Magritte himself, in an autobiographical lecture he gave in 1938, singled out this 13-year slice as absolutely foundational. And if you walk through the show and look at the pictures in it, you will see that there he laid the groundwork for everything he went on to do for the rest of his long career. Specifically, in 1926 was the year that he decided to stop painting in an abstract fashion. So people might not know it, but Magritte made quasi-cubist, he made quasi-futurist, he made quasi-abstract pictures. And in 26, he decided to return to painting objects in all their realizable detail. And he never looked back.
I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. My guest is Anne Unlam. She's the curator of the current MoMA exhibit, Magritte, The Mystery of the Ordinary. A little bit just about his early training prior to 1926, mm-hmm. formally trained, self-taught.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's well, I mean, of course, I'm going to say everything is interesting because I'm into it. But he has a double background. He trained both as a commercial artist, as a graphic artist, and in the Fine Arts Academy. And I think that in the show, we have some early examples of his graphic and commercial work. And I think that Magritte comes to make these bold, clear, legible, graphic types of images. You know, they have an instant legibility to them. And I think that has to, in part, be due to the fact that he's trained as an advertiser in addition to a fine artist.
So you begin the exhibition in 1926, and he had his first solo gallery show that year? Where was that?
Yes, that was in Brussels, Belgium. So as you said at the beginning, Magritte is a Belgian. He was born there, raised there, and with the exception of 3 years in Paris, he lived there for his entire life. So in the works in the first gallery of the exhibition were created in 1926 and 1927 in anticipation of this first one-person show at the Galerie Le Centaure in Brussels, Belgium, that Magritte and his Belgian surrealist friends saw as the moment when he would introduce himself, really, as Belgium's, at that point, only and leading surrealist painter. So it was a real debut.
So in the center of this time period you're focusing on, he does move to Paris, 1927. Why did he move?
He wanted to be part of a larger conversation, I think. He had met surrealist poets and painters like André Breton, Louis Aragon, Max Ernst, and I think, like many young artists today, come to New York to be part of a larger conversation. That's what drew him to Paris. He wanted to be at the center of the surrealist movement. And ironically, or actually it's probably predictably, when he got to Paris, in fact, he found that he couldn't find a place to live in the center of the city. So he moved to Paris, but he basically lived in a suburb. It took him 45 minutes to commute back and forth. But he did there become part of the surrealist group. He met artists like Joan Miró, Salvador Dali, Max Ernst, Paul Éluard. And I think during those 3 years, he went on to make more works and qualitatively more different types of works than he ever had before and ever would again.
And these contemporaries like Dali, did they accept him?
They did. By 1929 or so, he was clearly part of the he was a part of the surrealist group in a significant way. In fact, Salvador Dali, who moved to Paris in 1929, was the very first one to write about Magritte's Ceci n'est pas une pipe, The Treachery of Images. Dali wrote news from Paris column for the local paper back in Barcelona, and buried in that was this reference to the painter Marguerite, Dali loved to misspell his name, had painted a picture of a pipe that was not one.
So let's talk a little bit more about some of the specific images. You mentioned this one, probably one of the most famous, that this is not a pipe. Mm-hmm. I think at first you look at it because it's a darn fine painting of a pipe, and you go, of course it's a pipe. And then you go, oh, okay, I guess it's not a real pipe, it's a picture of a pipe. Was this revolutionary at the time?
I think at the time it was. To create a very clear picture of something that is so readily identifiable or nameable, and then to equally clearly and legibly and boldly underneath it say that it was not, was sort of threw language and meaning into question. And I think that, in fact, although now with the passing of years, that image and that strategy has become familiar. At the time, no one had ever done anything like that before. And I think that the minute why is it that that particular picture has so captured everybody's imagination? And I thought, because it's probably the one that best encapsulates the way that Magritte, in all of his painting, finds ways of reminding us that pictures of things are never the same as the things themselves in ways that are, you know, they're kind of simple and they're silly. Like this one makes me laugh, but at the same time, they're philosophically profound. And I can't think of any other artist prior to him who could do work like
that. And the use of words, because mm-hmm. he does that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Was that also revolutionary at the time?
He doesn't. In Paris, he does that a lot. And I suppose you could trace a lovely history of words in art that goes back to the Cubists, say, or to Picasso and Braque putting newspaper cutouts in their painting. But I think what Magritte does is he manages to destabilize language's meaning. I mean, that's another thing that Ceci n'est pas une pipe says. It borrows the format of a school primer. Like, we all can remember those little books you'd see that have a picture of an apple and it says apple underneath. Well, if Magritte did the book, it would say, this is not an apple.
This is not an apple. Yeah. Well, he does a similar thing that sort of messes with your head with the interpretation of dreams, which is these four panels and the seemingly everyday objects are just mislabeled.
Mm-hmm.
The caption under the leaf says, le table.
Right. Or I think the one in the show at MoMA is a very special one that was made for New York City, the interpretation of dreams. And that has six pictures in it. And yes, it's things like under a picture of a leaf, it says table. Under the picture of a glass, it says bird. But the sixth one in the lower right hand corner has a picture of a suitcase. And underneath it, it says valise. So just before you think you've gotten the rule.
Right. Just like you got the puzzle. No.
No, you don't. And even things that you think make sense shouldn't.
Some of his paintings are a bit disturbing as well. It's not all fun and games. He has one girl eating a bird.
Yeah.
Pleasure. I'm not sure what the pleasure part in parentheses is, but it's a girl.
And she's eating a bird.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Graphically depicted. I think Magritte was a big fan of detective stories, crime novels, and like many of the surrealists, wanted to shock his viewers out of any sort of complacency, and violent imagery was one way of attempting to do that. So that's part of the background for that painting.
Two paintings also that are a bit disturbing. The Titanic Days has a picture of a nude woman with a man sort of wrapped around her as part of that body.
Yes.
And then the Menaced Assassin, which is seemingly a dead woman on a table with a lot of people around.
Right.
Am I getting this right?
You are getting that very, very right. And I think that in the case of Titanic Days, which as you described does have, it's an image of a man superimposed over a woman. The first thing that you notice is that he is in the position of attack. The second thing I always notice about it is that Magritte has cropped his body to conform to that of the woman. So in a way, at first you think, oh, yes, right, threaten rapeseat violence against woman, and then look pictorially at what he had done to the male figure's body.
Right.
Which is
except
equally
for the left hand. I mean, you might think it was one person.
Yeah. Yes. Except for that left hand. Right. So this woman has sort of sibylline proportions. If you think of Michelangelo's Sistine Ceiling with those over-muscled ladies, that is what the female figure, quote unquote, in Titanic Days looks like. And that arm pushes the guy away. So suddenly there is a wedge of space in what otherwise would look like a very flat pictorial, almost collage-like composition.
I have to say, you know, I did a little Googling and found out that Magritte's mother had committed suicide. Any connection, you think, to this sort of family drama that unfolded in his depiction of women, or is this just too Freudian?
I think it's a bit Freudian. I think it's a bit after the fact. I think that Magritte began telling that story in the 40s, so several decades after those works were made. And I think he worked his whole life to try to create pictures that posed questions and provoked mysteries. So if one adds it all up with a nice biographical story, it makes it a little too simple. I do know that the art historian Sarah Whitfield, who has done so much important work on Magritte, has spoken about, and I think convincingly, about the fact that Magritte's mother was sick and she was depressed, and he would spend many childhood days in a very small, confined room with her. And if you begin to look at the types of spaces that Magritte depicts, and there is a certain claustrophobia about them, that begins to resonate in a certain way if you want to look back to childhood memories.
I think my favorite one, and if it ever comes up for sale and I win the lottery, I'm going to go for The Human Condition, which, once again, the title doesn't help at all in identifying which one it is, but it shows a landscape painting on an easel in front of a window through which we see the exact same landscape. You actually have to look at it twice to realize that there's a painting there at all.
Yes, yes, I do. I love that picture, too, and I love precisely the portions of it where Magritte establishes boundaries. And they're tiny, right? So it's like the top of the painting on the easel is this thin little line. He shows the tacking edge of it. He liked to say that the painting in the painting covered over exactly the portion of the landscape that was behind it. But of course, also, the minute you begin to look at it, you realize that trying to draw any distinction between the fiction of the work on canvas and the so-called reality of the landscape painted outside it is absolutely impossible, because the whole thing is a painted
invention.
We're
running a little short on time. Let me ask you about the cut-up paintings and what that was all about. He would do these in different pieces.
Right. He did a series of three works. He called them toiles découpées, or cut-up paintings. He also at times referred to them as painting objects. He was trying to make a new sort of picture, and one that was capable of intervening or being positioned rather directly in the world. He thought a lot about framing, clearly, Magritte, and about vision, and about how we look at things is always subjective. His friend Paul Nouget looked at one of those cut-up pictures and said, you know, it makes you think about how vision is always discontinuous. We see only what we are interested in seeing. And so Magritte created a type of work that was all about the gaps in between things as much as about being able to make a picture that adds up to some seamless whole.
Your exhibition ends in 1938, but he lives another almost 30 years.
He does.
How do you compare that whole last section into what you present in this exhibition?
I think Magritte goes on to make wonderful works in the 40s and 50s and 60s, but I think what we wanted to do with this show was really allow people to watch Magritte become Magritte, becoming the great artist of the 20th century that we all know.
You have a great website. We put links on the Leonard Lopate show page where you can get to both your website, and we have images on ours. I'm just curious, as a curator, the website for these sorts of things almost becomes just as important, I guess, as the big picture mm-hmm. for you, right?
I love the way that today we have so many different platforms for getting out images and information about the show, and that it gives people many different ways of experiencing the works. And you are right that the web becomes as important as the publication, as the didactic materials, as the acoustic guide. It's just a wonderful way, I think, of enhancing what people can bring to the exhibition.
But there's nothing like seeing it in person. And in New York, anyway, you only have 10 more days, although I think it's going on tour, right?
It is. The show is co-organized MoMA, the Menil Collection in Houston, and the Art Institute of Chicago. And it will be in Houston for Valentine's Day, February 14th.
I've been speaking with exhibition organizer Anne Unlamed about the exhibit of the surrealist work of artist Rene Magritte. That's at MoMA through January 12th. Anne, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.